Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, some parents are surprised to discover raising kids can be kind of a drag sometimes, but it doesn't have to be. KJ Dell'Antonia joins us this hour. She's a mother of four who wrote and edited the New York Times Motherload blog for 5 years, and her recent book is a kind of masterclass in the art of bringing up decent, independent young humans without sacrificing your own happiness. We'll talk about why families are better off when children have regular chores, even if they have demanding school schedules. We'll get some ideas for managing hectic mornings, sibling rivalries, and extracurricular activities. And we'll talk about what moms and dads should and should not do when homework is sucking the joy out of family life. Our conversation starts after a short break. You've heard of the paradox of Schrödinger's cat. Imagine a cat that is somehow simultaneously alive and dead inside a box that also contains poison, some radioactive material, and a Geiger counter. It's actually a thought experiment designed to illustrate a problem in quantum mechanics, which I'm sure we will talk about some other day on this show. But the paradox itself, I think it's one that a lot of parents can relate to. It is at least theoretically possible to truly love your children and to really dislike much of the business of parenting. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As a partner in a two-career marriage and the mother of four children, KJ Dell'Antonia experienced that parenting paradox herself more often than she wanted to until she went looking for ways to keep the joy alive. Dell'Antonia is a regular contributor to the New York Times and author of the new book, How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. She joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio to talk about it. KJ, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you have this realization that I think a lot of us feel but are afraid to say out loud, which is that parenting is, as you put it, often actively unpleasant. It's not something anybody imagines before they have kids. What makes it so unpleasant?
Well, it's a lot of work. Compared to, I think, a life without children, it's as they always say of Ginger Rogers, it's dancing backwards in heels, mm-hmm. right? Everything that you do, you also have to take into account these other humans that you have helped to create and are now in charge of feeding and raising and housing and generally keeping sort of alive and vaguely happy. And that's hard.
So you say that it helps to reframe the whole experience to try enjoying the adventure of parenting rather than trying to measure success. Because I guess until they're fully grown and out of the house, there will be things they failed to do.
Well, yeah, there will be lots of them. Plus, for most of us, I mean, that's not, I don't think, we don't want to go into this and then go, well, geez, at least in 18 years, they'll be out of here, right? We're not shooting for done. I mean, that's not really the goal of this. The goal of having a family, when we sort of sat down and decided to do this thing, as most of us did. I mean, most of our children were not wished upon us by fairies or good or bad luck. A lot of us, we set out to create these lives and these children, and sometimes worked really hard at that, right? So I wanted to think about how we could enjoy the process, the day-to-day, the stuff we're in all the time, and not just be like, well, I must be vaguely more satisfied and joyful with my life because, of course, my family comes first.
All things being equal, you say happier parents foster their kids' independence rather than being very heavily involved at all levels. It makes perfect sense, but KJ, it's not the kind of parenting our generation has embraced.
It's not. We have a real culture of overparenting. And I will say that happier parents, at least according to the research that I did, they're more involved when their kids are younger, and then they move towards fostering independence as kids grow older. So there's an evolution there of being, very there and very helpful and very in on things, and then backing up as kids are more able to do more for themselves.
Do you think most parents worry too much?
Yeah. I mean, how can we not? It's really hard not to worry about kids, and I'm sure that is a generational... I'm sure generations of parents have worried about kids. We may worry in a different way because when we look at our kids' adult lives, we see the possibility that they're going to be different than ours. And even when we look at our kids day to day, we also see a lot of differences, especially when it comes to screens and social media and the ways that they communicate with one another. So I think we perceive ourselves as facing sort of a scary landscape of difference. Although if you look back historically, it's not that unusual.
We also make this mistake in assuming that what we're struggling with now with a kid or kids is going to be permanent, right? So we assume that a kid will never learn to do her chores without being told or never apply himself in school. Why do we think these are forever problems instead of just temporary bumps in the road?
You know, I used to think that was just me. I would always assume like that this child, you know, he always used to nap and now he's not napping and he will never nap again and my life is over and I'm never going to achieve anything. And yeah, I would just spiral right down. So there's something about, no, you know, a phase that just always feels permanent. But, you know, within that context, I do want to say that it is possible that your child will never learn to do their chores without being asked.
But hopefully at some point it won't be your problem anymore. They will be dealing with their own household.
It's your job to make sure that they do them, not to take on the burden of feeling terrible if you have to ask every single time.
Yeah, there's this old saying that parents can only be as happy as their unhappiest child. And to this you say nonsense. Like, just because they're upset about doing their chores or they had a fight with a friend at school, we want to support them, but we don't have to necessarily be miserable ourselves.
I think it's much better if we're not. It's better for us, but interestingly, it's also better for them. So one of my sayings is that you can be happy when your children are not, and that is one that definitely gets people, you know, their shoulders go back and they get a little tense because that does not sound right. But really, some of the joy of being a grown-up comes in having a grown-up perspective, right? So you know, there will be another balloon. There will be another Thomas train. There will be another birthday party. There will be another girlfriend. There will be another Spanish test. There will be another college. Some of those things are really hard to watch a kid go through. But when we take their unhappiness onto ourselves, we're losing that adult perspective. And also, we're taking it away from them. So, you know, imagine if you're the kid and when you don't make the soccer team, your dad is beside himself, really just upset, just as, you know, as miserable as you are. And you get a couple of messages from that. And one of them is, oh, man, if I don't make a team, my dad gets really unhappy. Mm-hmm. And despite all appearances, our kids don't like it. They don't like to make us unhappy. So maybe I should not try out. That might be better. Or, okay, when my dad can tell that I am unhappy, that makes him really unhappy. So maybe I shouldn't tell him when I feel bad because that's really upsetting for him. And especially when kids are younger, well, and even when they're teenagers, it can be really distressing for them to feel like, I mean, what the message that we're conveying when we get as upset as they do is, wow, that really is a huge problem.
Yeah.
When maybe the message you want to be sending is, there'll be another team. It's okay. This is not, you know, it's not world ending.
My mom used to do something when I was a kid that I did with my own kids, which was that if we would fall down, before she knew if there was anything wrong or not, she would say, oh, you're okay. And, you know, 99 times out of 100, we actually were.
Yeah. And it's important for kids to get that message from us that, yes, the things that happen to them are important. We obviously care. We're deeply involved with them. But on the other hand, we have our own lives so that, you know, our emotions are, and our happiness are not entirely dependent on them. And we also can see for them that there is a future in which the fact that they did not make the top fifth grade soccer team will probably not matter.
Your mantra is, if you see something, don't always say something. So how do you decide which battles to pick and when?
That's hard, isn't it? I think a lot of us feel like every time you see a child screw up, you need to jump on that. You know, like every time, I'm trying to think of a good example here, but you know, every time they walk by their brother and flick their head with their finger, you know, that little flicky thing that siblings do. And Sometimes you can just let that go. Or the kid that's just doing the annoying thing, like, you know, standing at the cabinet and twiddling the drawer handle or just sort of bouncing. You just want to say stop that or twirling their hair or whatever. Stop that. Quit that. Don't do that. Really, we can let some of that stuff go.
And that's for our own good as much as theirs.
Yes. It's only going to make you crazy. You can't correct everything. Plus, you end up in this sort of cycle of all the only conversation I ever have with this child is correcting them. Mm-hmm. And when you start to feel that, man, you really need to start letting some stuff go just for the sake of both of your relationships.
All right, let's talk about mornings. Why are they such a disaster in so many households?
Mornings are so hard. I mean, mornings are tough because everybody has to be somewhere earlier than anybody wants to be anywhere. And most of us are not ready to go. And some of us, in the case of a family with young children, are not capable of getting ourselves up and out, nor are we voluntarily doing this thing. It's just huge and painful. And one of the things to remember about mornings is that it's hard for everybody. And it's hard in part because there's a lot that we don't control. We don't control what time our older kids have to be at school. We don't control what time we need to be at work. There are things about that we don't change. So there's like this sort of eternally clicking deadline where you can see whether or not you're going to achieve the goal. And it just can get very, very fraught.
So getting up earlier can be helpful. Is that for both parents and kids or just for moms and dads who maybe can get on top of things before the kids are up and around?
It's a little bit of both. So what I tell people is that I've got two useful pieces of advice about mornings. And one of them you're going to like and the other one you're not. And the one that nobody likes and the one that's really boring and just makes everyone roll their eyes is mornings are better when you get more sleep. But the big problem with that is that you can't get more sleep in the morning. I mean, everybody would be totally happy to, right? Oh, sure, I'll roll over. I'll take another hour. I'll take two. No problem. That is not the way mornings work. Instead, you have to get your more sleep on the other end. And what happens on the other end, that's bedtime. And none of us want bedtime, largely because we have these really gloriously full lives at the moment. So many opportunities, so much ability to do great things. So a lot of the time we find that for us as adults and for our kids, especially teenagers, we're not off somebody else's clock until quite late at night. You know, if you look at your teenager, they're not done with their sports practice and their choir practice and their, you know, after school meeting with a club and then their homework until 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And if they have to be up at 6 o'clock in the morning, they've already blown getting the amount of sleep that they need for physical health. And it's not until then that they were like, I can do my own thing, right? And adults are the same way. We're emailing, we're going back to work to do our second shift, especially if we're the kind of sort of flexible parent that stops in the afternoon to deal with the fact that our kids get off school way before most of us get off work and has to go back and do the rest of our work. We don't get a chance to do what we want to do basically until bedtime, and that makes it really hard to go to bed. So the solution for that is got nothing to do with mornings. It's not always necessarily a solution either, but it's to really look at the things you're choosing to do with your afternoons and evenings while keeping in mind that we all want that hour, 2 hours of Netflix and Snapchat, and just chilling, right? But if you don't start that until 10, you're doomed.
So have you found a good way to convince teenagers that's true?
You know, there's interesting research out there that both with young, so tweens and very young children, when you talk to them about why they need sleep and getting in the rhythm of having good sleep, they actually will work on it themselves. And with teenagers, you can get through with a message that is going to reach your specific child, because there's a ton of research out there about sleep, right? Better grades, better health, better, you weigh less. You just kind of can be better in a lot of different ways. So finding the one that interests your teen can be a great way to reach them when it comes to sleep.
My guest is KJ Dell'Antonio. We're talking about her book, How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or on Twitter at KERA Think. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times contributor KJ Del Antonio, whose new book is How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, KJ, there are a lot of kids today who are balancing music theory classes and taekwondo and volunteer work and a really heavy homework load. And mom and dad sometimes think, well, they're so busy that they should get a pass on helping out around the house. You say, not so fast.
I think that's a mistake for the kids and for the parents. It's hard to be happy when you feel like you're doing all the work in a household. It's hard to sort of, you know, send that kid merrily off to do his homework when you have to clean up the dinner that you just made and probably head back to your emails yourself. And also, kids who are raised that way are not learning to contribute, to be a part of a community, to be a part of a family, to be empathetic when they look at other people and see them having to do some work. It's just not the greatest. It's really not great for anybody.
Some kids push back so hard and so reliably that parents just give up because they don't want all that conflict every day. What do you suggest to those families who have kids that just never make it easy?
It is absolutely 100% true that it would be easier to do it yourself. It will always be true. It would be easier to go and pick up the towel off the floor of the bathroom and just hang it. And not go get the child who left it on the floor of the bathroom for the fourth day of the row, even though you've gone and gotten them for the past 3 days. It's easier to let it go. It 100% is. But what you want now is not always what you want later. And what you want is to raise a child that understands that living in a place with other people means accommodating their need for you not to mold the wood on the floor of the bathroom.
You also say it can be helpful if everybody is doing chores simultaneously, working together or not, but there's like, whatever, an hour every afternoon or on the weekends or something when the whole family pitches in.
Well, that's not actually something I do. That's something. So in every chapter of the book, not only do I talk about, you know, what makes this hard for all of us and some of the things that maybe I have done if I have been successful, and chores are a really tough area in our family, I gotta say. So what I did was go out and talk to parents who felt good about chores. And that was when I got back a lot. People did what they called a power hour or the hour of power. That was a really popular rhyme where they just all got together, often on a weekend morning, always at the same time, turned on some music and cleaned. I even talked to one family that only cleaned for the length of the song American Pie, which is a really long song.
It is long. So just last night, KJ, I messaged my girlfriends about how much I hate homework. Not my homework, which I do every night to be prepped for the show, but my daughter's homework. You remind us it is not our homework. How is it that we start by intending to be just a resource and we end up being like a full-time homework coach? How do we slide over there?
It's really hard. You know, every teacher and every school administrator that I talked to wanted parents to understand that when we take on any part of the homework, either making sure it gets back into the backpack or making sure that it gets done or making sure that it gets done right, we are taking away some of the point of the homework, which in many cases, especially with younger children, is no more than the idea that they can take it home and then bring it back. Or maybe it's to see whether or not they can complete a task or do a particular kind of math without the teacher's in-class help. But if they're getting our help at home, we've blown that for the teachers. Now, a lot of teachers tell me that at this point, they've kind of just accepted that. They've abandoned the idea of homework as useful in that respect because so many of us feel like it's our job to make sure that it gets done. But it's really, it's our kids' job.
So teachers, most teachers are actually okay with the fact that homework gets turned in and it's not all correct. Because I think this is one thing that people get hung up on is that it has to be perfect.
Right. No, teachers want to know whether or not the child has understood enough to do it on their own. They want to know where they need to, you know, teach more or do more. They want to see what the kids can do. And a lot of the time when we look at an assignment, you know, we see my child has to put together an oral report on this book wearing a costume and using note cards. So we see sort of this big, huge task. And what the teacher is really seeing is, I would like this child to stand up in front of the class and address the classroom without, you know, reading. And that's like their whole goal. So we as parents, when we want to like make these assignments perfect or make these projects perfect, we miss what the teacher is trying to, you know, trying to get the kids to step and up and do, and ideally without a lot of help. If you are finding yourself looking at your second grader's projects and panicking because they look like they were done by a 7-year-old, something's gone wrong.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number 1-800-933-5372. Nora is calling from Dallas. Hi, Nora.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question about motivation. How can we motivate our kids to put more effort in whatever they do?
Thanks for your call.
Motivation, well, you know, it depends on what we are talking about here. If we're talking about homework, I feel like one of the joys of that is that it's partly the school's job to help motivate them. So if what you're finding is that your child doesn't do their homework unless you get all over them, maybe you can take a step back and see what happens when they don't do the homework. Maybe the school will get all over them and then you don't have to be the homework police. When it comes to chores, I feel like it's not necessarily our job to motivate our kids to want to do chores, because nobody wants to do chores. It's our job to ensure that our kids are doing what we expect them to do to help us make the family run smoothly. There's kind of a difference.
At what point should parents contact teachers about the homework load? And at what point should we say to our kids, if you have a problem with this homework or how much you have to do every night, you need to talk to the teacher?
Well, a lot of that depends on how old your kids are. I think for most kids, even very young ones, starting with self-advocacy is great. And it depends on, you know, what kind of a problem you're seeing. I remember once my child was bringing home homework and it was this new idea that they were going to do the homework online and it was this new program and they were supposed to type in the vocabulary sentences, but my kid was in second grade and couldn't type. And I contacted the teacher and said, well, you know, how's he going to do this if he can't type this? And the whole point was just to like to recreate this sentence. And she said, well, it's okay if you type them for them. And I was like, but if I'm typing the, but then whose homework is this? And they, you know, at that point, they sort of everyone just laughed. It had seemed like a good idea and it wasn't. So sometimes it's just that simple and the kid isn't even going to see it. I mean, my kid was totally willing to sit there and sort of pick out one word at a time for like hours because it was Gloria's computer and at the time that seemed wonderful. So sometimes you do need to take it on yourself. But if you can start with the child going to the teacher and either saying, I don't understand this, or you told me this should take me 20 minutes a night and it's taking me an hour. What am I doing wrong? Can you help me? Then that's a really great place to start.
So to have a sibling is to have a sparring partner. How and when should we get involved in our kids' arguments with one another?
That is another tough one. So many of these things depend on sort of the children's age and experience. So when kids are young, it's really important that we help them learn to deal with that sibling, right? So often we find ourselves sitting down and saying, well, we have a problem, guys, because Sarah wants to build with blocks, but, you know, Mildred is really in the mood to knock blocks over today, and this is not going so well for you guys. So what can we do? And, of course, they're screaming. They're not, you know, they're not sitting down politely and
right,
talking with you over that. You know, you don't expect that, but you're trying to teach them to, you know, to hear two points of view and maybe even get to the point where Mildred says, well, I'm mad because I want to build two and Sarah won't let me. And you kind of, you want to give them some tools so that someday they could possibly talk to each other or maybe somebody else about this stuff. Then as they get older, you really start to need to step away and let them use those tools. And then, you know, it gets really tricky because one thing I find is that siblings can be so mean to each other that
right,
it feels like you really need to go in there because, man, that was like the nastiest thing that one human being could say to another. And the truth is that sometimes that's what your brothers and sisters do. And it's kind of awful, but you just kind of have to let it happen.
Yeah, I remember reading years ago that for a lot of us, dealing with sibling conflict really kind of established our conflict strategies as adults, which is to say there's not always going to be someone else, right, to moderate those fights. We should let them get, I mean, not physical fights, but let them argue it out sometimes.
Right. And like I said, this can be really tough. I personally, you know, I have four kids, and I found that I really was inclined to intervene too much. And I would often intervene on one side or the other because, you know, when you sort of walk in and you suddenly hear one child shriek, you're the fattest, ugliest person that ever walked the planet. Obviously, you're going to leap in to defend the child that is not the fattest, ugliest person to ever walk the planet. But you didn't hear. You didn't hear what went before. Uh-huh. You didn't see what went before. You don't know where that, and you won't know. You're not going to know till they're giving the toasts at each other's weddings what was really going down. So sometimes you just have to go, okay, I'm just going to pretend I didn't hear that and go somewhere else, unless, you know, there's dumb stuff that you know cannot be said, and your family and your kids should know that too. There are some moments when you really have to intervene where it's getting just completely out of hand. But by and large, with older kids, erring on the side of not is probably happier for you, and it's probably going to work out better for them in the long run. Like, they'll probably have a shorter fight if you don't get in there.
So I never dealt with this, but I know that it doesn't necessarily mean that you're raising a monster if you have a little one who says they really despise the newborn sibling that has come into their life. What do we do with that?
Yeah. Then you'd say, oh, man, you know, I get it. It's hard to have somebody come in here and take all my attention. That really blows. And then just, you know, how about after I put the baby down, you and me will watch a great episode of Thomas the Tank Engine together. I might doze off, but that's okay. You know, it doesn't have to be like, it's not an exchange. It's just, I hear you. I get that.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go back to the phones now. Let's speak with Rita in Dallas. Hi, Rita.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'm going back many years now because my children are much, much older. In fact, they have grandchildren. But I don't recall ever pressuring my kids to do homework because I felt like if they didn't do it, they would suffer what we would call the natural and logical consequences at school.
Thanks so much for your call. That sounds not so different from what you're talking about, KJ.
You know, and that's a great way to approach it. I think a lot of parents will hear that and say, but it's different now. It's different because, A, they have more homework. And it's different because, B, if they don't do the homework right in fourth grade, then they won't get into accelerated math in fifth grade. And if they don't get into accelerated math in fifth grade, they probably won't be doing algebra by the end of ninth grade. And if they're not doing algebra by the end of ninth grade, how will they get through calculus? And if they've gotten through calculus, how will they get into SMU instead of, you know, potato chip state or whatever? That we spiral down that really, really, really fast. But Nora was right. That homework, you can't coddle the kid into the college of your dreams, which may not be the college of your child's dreams anyway. The goal is to raise a kid who can manage their own homework. And what we really want is for them to fail to do that in big ways before it matters, while they're still under our roof, while we can still help them. What we really don't want is for them to fail to do that their freshman year at fancyuniversity.com or whatever.
All right, Rita brought up natural consequences. Let's talk about consequences, because discipline is a really, you know, there was a time when parents knew exactly what to do. It was kind of spare the rod, spoil the child. Very few people think that's appropriate now, which I think is a good thing. But that leaves us unsure as to how to punish or correct bad behavior.
It really does. And even if you go back, I mean, spanking has been a big question and a debate for a long time. But what many of our parents had was more of a conviction that if a child did something wrong, you punished them, not, you grounded them, you took something away, you yelled at them, whatever that you chose to do. But there was a punishment, there was a consequence, and then you moved on. And now we're in more of this world of, well, you need to understand what went wrong and why did they do what they did. And, if I'm too aggressive in taking things away, then they're not going to listen to me. And so you're all worried about these things that you've read and heard and seen. But on the other hand, you're still supposed to keep your child quiet on an airplane, right?
Right.
So we're really in this bind of not having a sort of universally agreed upon strategy that we're all supposed to do. And if you just do it in front of everyone, they will at least forgive you for the screaming child. And yet still being expected to have our kids behave in public places.
So do you have any thoughts about, if somebody, let's just say one of your kids is defiant and you decide that you really can't be spoken to that way. What do you do?
I would say.
Or maybe your kids are never defiant.
Right? Yeah, my kids are not defiant. I'm happy, remember? Oh, my gosh. I told one of them the other day, I wrote a book about being a happier parent, not a better parent. Leave me alone. I say it, absolutely. And just as my father once said it to me, you can't talk to me that way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the end of that is go to your room. Sometimes it's, do you know why you can't talk to me that way? Sometimes it's, you really hurt my feelings and I am leaving.
Yeah.
But I definitely make sure that that child knows and hears. On the other hand, I sometimes let some of that go in ways that I don't know that my parents did. I have definitely got one child who's prone to sort of escalating up to the emotional heights of horror and screaming, if my brother does that again, I'm going to kill him, or, I hate you, or whatever. And if you just sort of stand there, about 2 minutes later, that child will back down and it'll all be fine. But if you go in with her, it gets ugly.
My guest is KJ Dell'Antonia. Her book is How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. We'll take some more calls after the break. The telephone number, 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at KERA Think. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times contributor and author KJ Dell'Antonia. Her new book is How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So my husband and I have four kids. They're a little older now, but it kind of kept the number of activities under control because it was physically impossible for them to each do 9 things. But for lots of families, there's a soccer team, but then there's brownies after school, and it gets hard to say no. How can families get the extracurricular grind under control?
It really does get hard to say no. I mean, we're in the same position when you have a lot of kids, budget and time mean they can't necessarily all do all the things that they want. So when you look at, one kid or two kids, budget and time should also say they can't necessarily do all the things that they want. It'd be lovely to get to do all the things that we want. To learn to cartoon and play the guitar and all that is other stuff. But it sounds really great when you're sort of looking at it, and maybe it even fits. Like maybe guitar is on Monday and Tuesday and cartooning is on Thursday and Friday. But, it feels okay. But we need to remember what I was talking about earlier about how much everybody wants that couple of hours of downtime, or younger kids. What they want is an afternoon when they can invite a friend over after school, right? There's sort of nothing sadder than your kid going, can I have Jack over? And you're like, well, I don't know, because Monday you have karate and Tuesday you have Kumon and Wednesday and Thursday are both soccer practice. I mean, that's just sad. Of course you can have Jack over. Let's leaving a space to have Jack over or whatever is really important. And when you have one of those kids that wants to do everything, talking to them about that, I get, you know, those things sound fun, but remember how much you like to have an afternoon when you can go play at somebody's house. Let's save an afternoon for that and just pick your top one or two.
Some of us have that kid who just really wanted to play piano and take lessons or really wanted to do softball, and then they realize they don't like it. You had a really interesting idea for what to do when a kid wants to quit something, say, mid-year.
Right. I talked to a lot of people about this, and I should say first that some families just don't put music in this category. For some families, music is mandatory, and you're always going to be taking something. So I talked to one mother who said, sure, I just say, yeah, you can quit violin. What instrument are you going to take up next? And usually they decide to stick with violin, and I was like, yeah, I might too. So for some people, that's just different. But when it comes to something where you are more flexible, there's sort of a question of, can a kid quit mid-season? Can they quit partway through? And you need to look at who was the impetus in some ways, and also whether there's a commitment to other people involved here. So letting a kid quit a team mid-season that's going to leave people in the lurch, that's not the right message for the kid or for anybody involved. So that kid probably needs to complete the season. For other things, it might not be as important. You may have already spent the money, but the money's gone, and you dragging your kid to something they don't want to do is not going to be fun either. So especially with young kids, sometimes it's better to let it go. But what a lot of parents I talked to said was, tell the kid they have to quit themselves. That they have to go in and say, you know, thank you very much, I won't be here next Wednesday. And sometimes they won't want to do that enough that they'll keep going, and maybe they're going to find that it's okay.
And I suppose if they do decide to walk in there, they feel the consequence of what is it like when you have to do this thing. You're basically not sparing them the kind of tiny punishment of, you know, being a little bit embarrassed to be leaving somewhere.
Yeah, and that's okay, because that sort of helps them next time to go, well, you know, do I want to stick this out so that I don't have to go through that? Or you don't want to teach kids to like stay in a job longer than they should because I suppose there are other sort of messages that are coming there. But a lot of it is just, you know, maybe I could go to two or three more pottery classes and just see how it goes. Maybe I'm not that uncomfortable. Maybe this is not that much of a problem. Or recognizing, you know, no, I've done too much. I can't get my geometry homework done if I'm doing this too. And therefore, it's really important for me to go in there and just say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be here for the rest of the term.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Jerry on the line in McKinney. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. Well, I tell you, I agree with what you were just talking about. I'm a private music instructor. But what I've noticed if over the years, if kids, young people come in for lessons and they didn't even want to do it to begin with, and the parents make them do it, it just doesn't really work well. And it doesn't. I mean, I'm not saying about for myself. It just makes it harder for them. And like I have some late teenagers, but when my kids were like around 10 years old, they were playing amazing, and I was so impressed with them. But then they decided, Dad, I'm not going to do this. And I didn't really push it too much because in that case, I wanted them to find their own path. Now, I agree with you, though, if it was like something in school or on a team, yes, of course, you want to finish it out. But I think in the case of like, say, music lessons, I would say it has to really be something that the children are at least interested or motivated to do it.
Thanks so much for that perspective and insight. It's interesting to hear, isn't it, KJ, from a teacher who sort of knows what it's like to deal with kids who don't want to be there.
Right, who's not saying, you know, well, you need to push them to practice for an hour a day because it doesn't get fun until you've mastered it, and you won't master it for another 9 years. Kids are self-motivated. Most kids are self-motivated about something. It may be Fortnite, and I recognize that is not necessarily going to like sort of fill your heart with the kind of joy that violin would. But We have to let our kids be who they are. And if who they are is not somebody that wants to spend all that time playing violin, stopping violin gives them time to find the thing that is really what they want to do.
You say that it's really important for parents to have lives and activities and pleasures that are just their own. What do you say to moms and dads? How do they ease back into that sort of entitlement to pleasure if they have overlooked their own needs for years?
Oh, it's so easy to do that. You know, you get this baby, right? And it's this sack of flour that cries all the time, and you have to take care of it 24/7. You're not even like
it's going to die, right?
Exactly. So you get used to this sort of idea that you must do everything for this thing that you've created. And then as you get to a point where, you know, it can be a little more independent, and maybe you could go and I spent a significant chunk of my childhood, or it feels that way to me, idly playing with tennis balls in the back of like an indoor tennis court behind these curtain things while my parents played tennis because that's what they liked to do. And I guess they couldn't get a babysitter, or maybe I was just too obnoxious to be left with one. That's a lot of us remember the things that our parents did as kids, and yet some of us just don't have something of our own to which we would say to our child, well, you know, I'm going off to my bike race this morning. I'm going to my master's swimming. Hey, I've got my own guitar lesson. We don't make being a grown-up look good when all we ever do is drive them to their things.
Yeah. The thing that I always thought was important was letting my kids know that I work because we need money, but I also work because I love it. I don't want them to think that I hate every minute that I'm at work.
No, because you don't want them to, you don't want that to be their expectation of adulthood and of working life. Yeah, and I'm always really careful. You know, people worry about cell phone use and doing that sort of thing in front of, you know, you're on your phone all the time in front of your children. And I'm always saying, you know, the reason that I could drive you to this Friday afternoon hockey tournament that we got sucked into, because it's really hard not to get sucked into stuff like that,
right,
is because I can send you in and you're going to have to play the first, you know, period or maybe even the first half while I'm out here doing this conference call, because, you know, I can do that. That's the sort of the gift and the curse of being able to be mobile with your work. Yes, we could come, but no, I'm not going to be in there watching the whole time.
Speaking of cell phones, I can't believe we haven't gotten here yet, because this is everybody's number one question these days. How do you decide rules about screen time?
First of all, if your kids are young enough, they should be your rules. If you have little kids who can't control their own devices and things, and yet somehow they're controlling how much screen time they get, perhaps by whining or sneaking or begging for your phone all the time, then you need to clarify. You need to set up some rules that are easier for them and easier for you. That's little kids. But as our kids get bigger, we need to remember that our goal is not to raise kids who can obey our screen time rules. It's to raise kids who can moderate themselves. And that is really, really hard. So we have to sort of evolve from this is the rule in our house, you can only do it at such and such a time and whatever, to a place of, yeah, you can do it when your work is done and you can do it when you think it's appropriate. Because we really, I feel strongly that when your kids are in high school, you need to be giving them some control over how much they're doing, because otherwise they're going to head off for freshman year and they're not going to know how to manage it without you there saying, well, you can't sleep with that phone right next to your bed.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I wonder how much you think, KJ, our expectations of parenting have been shaped by, like, the Pinterest perfection moments that people like to share, you know, that you're not really doing it right unless you've got this perfect, like, Gwyneth Paltrow kale and quinoa salad on the table and everybody's smiling. That's not reality for most people.
That's not reality for most people. And I would hope that most of us know that, but that doesn't mean it's not hard when you're feeling low and your kid has refused to pick their socks off the floor and your other kid is having a tantrum on the floor because math is just too hard, and you know, you flick into your Facebook and there's somebody picking apples.
Right.
that can be a really painful moment. So remembering that people only post one thing to do is sort of, what would you say to your kid about that? You know, if she's home and she's doing her homework and it seems like everyone else is posting pictures of themselves out doing fun things. It's like, well, do you post pictures of yourself doing your homework? You don't, right? So, you know, remembering that nobody is, well, most of us aren't posting the tougher moments. Some people are now. I feel like it's getting more open. We are talking a lot more about it not always being pretty.
And it's so gratifying, right? When people come out of the shadows and say, oh, that's happened to us too. And you think, oh, that's happened to Emily, who wins spelling bees and swimming medals right. every weekend.
I love hearing that other people, my kids still hit each other sometimes, even though they're 17, 14, 12, and 12. And mm-hmm. I really thought that they would grow out of that. And it is so reassuring to me when somebody else, you know, shares that their 12-year-old just, you know, conked their other 12. I mean, I'm not talking like abuse. I'm not.
Right.
You're just like, what? At what point do you stop touching each other when you don't want to be touched? Come on.
What about vacations where we have really like loaded them with a lot of expectations for perfect moments?
We do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bad moments make for great vacation memories, right? So we got that going for us. The broken rental car window, the air conditioning that didn't work. Yeah. And we also mostly remember the better stuff about our vacations. So we got that going for us, too. We do. We put a lot of burden on, you know, the one weekend or the one trip without realizing that we have sort of this all these years to create a history of all of this traveling together. And it doesn't all have to go beautifully. And other people are only posting pictures of the beautiful moments. Maybe you want to post a picture of your kid having a tantrum because their ice cream is on the ground. That might be nice for everyone.
My favorite vacation moment was, well, now, it wasn't funny at the time, but my kids got lice. I discovered this when we were on our way to Sedona, Arizona. So we pulled into a Walmart in Roswell, New Mexico, and bought lice shampoo. And this was like a daily part of our vacation that week, was combing out their hair with the metal comb.
Yeah, my kids got lice when we were visiting my parents, who actually live in McKinney. And we had to deal, and my mom was thrilled. Yeah. Yeah, it just, you know, these things happen, and it's funny now, and it wasn't funny then. And, you know, you take your two-year-old to Disney World, and the thing that they like most is the playground that you could go to anywhere on you take them all to somewhere really wonderful, amazing, and then they come home and they say, you know, Grandpa, we get to eat at McDonald's four times, and you just want to. But that's, you know, everybody has a good time in their own way, I guess.
You call happier parenting a goal of motion, and it sounds like that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a journey, right? That's what we were talking about at the beginning of the hour. The goal is not to finish. You don't want to be done with this, right? You want this to be a great, large chunk of your life that you savor.
KJ Delantonio's new book is How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. KJ, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you.
You can find us on Twitter at KERA Think, and we do hope you become a Think Podcast subscriber using any podcast app you like. You can also learn about upcoming shows at our website. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.